It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Halloween is a great time of year to be a thrill seeker. Many people search for an adrenaline kick of fear in haunted attractions, horror movies, and pranks. But why? What makes a good scare so thrilling? And do other cultures enjoy recreational fear in the same ways? If you visited Scarehouse recently, you may have been part of research which explores these questions. Greg Siegel, director of the program in Cognitive Affective Neuroscience at the University of Pittsburgh, and sociologist Margie Kerr are here to talk about their Ecological Emotional Experience Protocol, or EEP, experiments, and Kerr's forthcoming book, Scream, Adventures in the Upside of Fear. Greg Siegel, Margie Kerr, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Great to have you both here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
And we'd like to know what scares you. What gives you the creeps, and what do you enjoy about being scared? Join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essspgh, hashtag EPLive. Scarehouse received approval from the University of Pittsburgh to conduct a study at Scarehouse with customers going through the basement attraction. And of course, Margie, you are connected to Scarehouse. And so you're doing this research for your book. So you're all about this experiment.
Oh, yeah.
So explain how this came about. I'm assuming that Greg or somebody at Pitt approached you about this.
Well, I actually reached out to Greg as part of my research for my book.
So it was the other way around.
Yeah, yeah. And we just started talking, and I shared what my involvement was with Scarehouse. And over the course of conversations, we just thought, hey, we could do some testing here. So Greg really took the lead in setting up the protocol and designing the study to look at customers before and after they go through to then find out what was happening, what kind of change there was after experiencing the basement.
It's funny because this sounds like something that would be in a horror movie. Like, we're going to measure your fear and what scares you. You know, kind of like that movie with Vincent Price, The Tingler. Greg, how do you measure a person's fear? How are you doing this?
We have a few measures that get indirectly at aspects of fear. We have electroencephalography, or EEG, which are electrodes that we put on your head that measures what's going on in your brain.
So I walk into Scarehouse and it's like, here, let me put these electrodes on your head.
That's right. And again, we're testing people before and after. We're not yet testing them as they go through.
Oh, okay.
So beforehand, you walk down the stairs into our lab area, which is an industrial bathtub that's kind of covered with blood. And there's a little broom closet where you actually get tested. We put EEG on your head. We have your heart rate being measured. We have your galvanic skin response being measured, which is kind of how much you sweat. And together we get a picture of how aroused you are and what you're thinking about.
So it's a before and after picture, basically.
Currently, yeah. We are approved to measure during, and we're going to start that soon, we hope.
Before Halloween? But like during these last?
We may, depending on how much we can get running.
Okay, because that's when you get all the customers, right, Margie? Or a lot of them.
Yes, Scarehouse has been busy since the end of September. So, yeah, surprisingly, Halloween itself is not the busiest night of the year. Everybody is out at the parties and trick-or-treating. So our busiest days are usually the weekend before and then, you know, this week right now leading up to Halloween.
So as you've begun to look at some of these measurements, I'm assuming that you have, Greg, what trends are you seeing?
We can't say very much yet. The study's not quite done, but I can give you hints of what we've been seeing. After you go through the Scarehouse, people don't get startled as easily. When you ask them just to sit still, a lot of the mental chatter that's normally going on seems to be gone. So what the Scarehouse is doing, hopefully, is confronting people with enough emotion that they don't have to be going over in their head in the same emotional ways that they would in their everyday life.
How much of this is an individual thing and just depends on who you are?
So there's a lot of data saying that some people scare really easily. Some people need a higher level of arousal just to function than others. So we think there's quite a bit of variation that is individual differences.
As you say that, we could be talking about something other than being scared, but obviously, fear is what we're looking at here. And what is the objective? Once you accumulate all of this data, What do you do with it?
Well, treatments for mental health in this country are generally about decreasing emotion. That is to say, we have pills that help you to be less emotional. We have therapies that help you to down manage your emotions.
Is that a good thing? To suppress your emotions?
So this is the question. This is what we do. Somehow people come out of the scare house and they feel great. They feel exuberant and they feel like they can take on the world. And we looked at this, and this is where Margie and I got talking and saying, how's that working? It's a very different model. So then we want to say, what is it doing in the brain? And if we understand that, we would be using that information to create a different kind of treatment for mental health.
And if you hold it in, yeah, I would think you wouldn't feel as well. And if you take it to a supernatural or, you know, made up scenario, you've got the tingler. You've got this thing growing inside of you that because you're not releasing your fear. And so by holding the fear inside, you are, the point being that you're doing something detrimental to yourself.
Well, we believe that a lot of anxiety is about not confronting the thing you're anxious about. That's what worry is. It's a way of keeping you from actually experiencing the thing you're afraid of. Here, you get to get face to face with ghosts and goblins and ghouls, and you confront those fears. All of a sudden, the everyday comparisons to the worst thing in your life, you know, somebody calling you a name, pale by comparison. And perhaps you're in a much better place for dealing with these very low-level challenges that we go through every day.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation about what scares you. How do you deal with your fear? And are you someone who really needs a recreational fear fix? Is that necessary in a world that in reality is so scary? Why do we need these fantasized frightening scenarios in our lives? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Margie, I want to talk about your book. What kind of research have you been doing, and what can you tell us about fear in different cultures, which I know you've been looking into?
Yeah, I have been doing probably the best type of research ever, which is basically going to different countries and doing as many scary and thrilling things as I possibly can. So I was in Japan. I rode, you know, a ton of roller coasters, went to lots of haunted houses, went to lots of different scary themed entertaining
in Japan.
In Japan, yes.
Now, this is a country that's had, you know, an atomic bomb dropped on it. So yet the Japanese have given us Godzilla. They've created all these things in their culture that that scare us and themselves. Why is that?
Well, they do it really well, too. I mean, they have some fantastic scary material across different mediums. And what I saw is that it is a little bit different than here in the U.S. A lot of the traditional Japanese haunts, they don't have as much blood and gore. It's more about storyline. It's more about being immersed in some larger kind of world. And definitely every haunted house that I went to there had that set up. You had to read a story. You had to watch a film so that you knew what you were getting into. And I really do feel like that made it all the better. And, you know, I would come out the other end and think, yes, I actually participated in this task. A lot of the haunts there had you complete tasks. But what I did see is that, you know, Tokyo is very safe. It's a very safe country, and they do have a very high engagement with scary material. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. I wonder if that is something that, you know, could hold up across the board, that, you know, maybe countries that are very safe have high engagements with symbolic violence or scary material. And when I went to Colombia and stayed in Bogota, I saw that, you know, they don't have a lot of haunted – they really don't have a haunted house industry. They don't have a ton of kind of scary material. Their shows that are based around horror don't do very well on broadcast TV. And it is also a country that has a high rate of actual violence.
Well, right. It's the home of the Medellin cartel.
Yes. And it's much safer than it was, say, 20 years ago. But everybody there still remembers the time and, you know, it's still ongoing conflicts with the paramilitary groups and threats of kidnapping and then just the street violence. And so I started thinking, wow, this could be a really nice kind of hypothesis to say, countries that have high rates of actual violence have low rates of engagement with symbolic violence. And it sounds really nice, but you've got lots of examples that counter that. So Mexico, for example. But I do think that there's something there. I think that there is a relationship between the safety of a society, or perhaps even just the perceived safety and engagement with scary material. So that's really where I want to go in the future, too, is trying to understand that relationship.
Is there something to be said for the what sounds like a very cerebral approach to recreational fear in Japan as opposed to how we do it here? And this is not a knock against any haunted houses per se, but where we get so caught up in the blood and the gore, and it gets to the point where you're not leaving anything to the imagination, which I'm guessing, Greg, is scarier than the reality.
Sometimes what you can make up in your head is usually a lot worse than what you experience in the real world.
Yeah, now, and in Japan, they definitely had that kind of, you know, narrative and storyline involved in some of the haunts, but they also have really just fun kind of theme restaurants designed around horror. So, you know, bars where everything – it looks like a Spirit Halloween store turned into a bar. So they take a very, I think, lighthearted approach to engagement with scary material too.
Go ahead, Greg.
Just a lot of the trick often seems to be getting your mind primed to do its thing. So use something that is somewhat scary to get your limbic system going, which makes you aroused, and to get some of your memory systems going, which makes you remember things that were scary. And then you'll spin on your own. So little pushes go a long way.
Something that you see a lot this time of year, in addition to the monsters and jack-o'-lanterns and ghosts and that kind of thing, are the weird crazed clowns, which are supposed to be fun but seem to be that thing. If there's one universal thing that's in our – that, you know, it seems like we're always drawing upon some childhood nightmare that scares us into adulthood, and so much of it is connected to clowns, it seems. Is that a reoccurring theme, are you finding?
Yeah, clowns are so fascinating, because I think that most people today, when they think of a clown, the image that comes to mind is not of the happy kind of joyful clown,
no,
but
which
the
is
evil
what it's
monster
meant
clown. Yeah, and but you know, it's really transitioned from, you know, when clowns first were around, they've always been kind of these pranksters, tricksters, people who were, you know, kind of pushing the boundaries of what normal, acceptable behavior is. And that was really the history of the clown. So the idea that a clown is a friendly, joyful character is actually, I think, the more difficult image to imagine. So today, though, there's been so many movies, so many depictions of clowns as monsters, that's just kind of the immediate image that we think of.
There's also good reason from neuroscience and why clowns should be so scary. That is to say, the amygdala, a deep buried brain structure, the lizard brain structure that responds to fearful things, responds to the whites of eyes a lot. And if the whites of eyes are bigger and wider, you get more of this activity that really is the neural substrate of fear. Similarly, it seems to respond – Christine Larson's work shows that it responds to upside-down triangles, like sharp teeth, big pointy things. A lot of the elements of clown faces really are geared toward getting our fear systems moving.
So a lot of people will be thinking about It, you know, with Tim Curry this time of year. No matter where you live in the world today, life is scary. I mean, there are just so many real-life things to be afraid of. So why do we need recreational fear?
Well, I think that our world today, you know, compared to 200 years ago, is very safe for most Americans. And that's going to vary by geography, by socioeconomic status. But, you know, we
– How would you – why would you say that? I mean, and a lot of people would agree with you. But in light of, you know, there's the – whether it's real or perceived, there's the Ebola scare. There is ISIS, you know, and beheadings and all of these things that, you know, seem to be the byproduct of somebody's medieval imagination in our world today.
And we think about those things and they scare us, but they're not actually going to influence most of us. Most of us are not going to have a direct impact on our lives by these things. Yeah. And we are, you know, in 1890, I believe the life expectancy was around 45 years. If you woke up, you were happy to be alive. You weren't going to, you know, be concerned about what was going to happen 50 years from now because, again, your focus was on making it through a difficult, dangerous job in the factory or on the farm.
In 1890?
In 1890, I believe I actually have it here. And today the life expectancy is around 80 years old. So our fears, you know, our daily threats have changed. You know, we're not as impacted by acute infectious disease, even though in light of the Ebola threat, we've found vaccines for most things that were the big killers 200 years ago. You know, we have things to be afraid of, but objectively, we are safer.
So why do we need this recreational fear, Greg?
So there are – people have a requisite level of arousal, and some people just aren't getting that. If you look at, for example, people who cut themselves or harm themselves, sure, 65% of people are doing that to reduce their emotion. But there's another 25% who say they're cutting themselves just to feel something. And people talk a lot about numb in our society. We go through life numb. There are different brain structures that are involved in anticipating fear that's miles away, as you say, like Ebola, versus something that is right present threat. And these get our arousal systems going. It turns out that we actually work optimally at a moderate level of arousal. If your arousal is too low, you're numb or you're not invested, you sit on your couch. If it's too high, you're paralyzed and can't function. But somewhere in the middle, Yerkes and Dodgson in 1925 said that's where we perform optimally. And I think people spend a lot of time trying to get themselves to a place they feel they could really perform optimally.
So the idea of being scared and our, for some people, the addiction may be strong, too strong a word, but the idea of the excitement of being frightened is part of just the thrill of being alive, tapping into that.
I think that for some people, sensation seeking is seeking something that makes them feel alive, yes.
Well, it's been fascinating. Greg Siegel is the director of the program in cognitive affective neuroscience at the University of Pittsburgh, and sociologist Margie Kerr has a forthcoming book called Scream, Adventures in the Upside of Fear, and she is one of the people behind Scarehouse, and we thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It wouldn't be Halloween without you. Coming up, we'll explore the region's haunted history with Thomas White, author of the book Supernatural Lore of Pennsylvania. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.